I'm Artie Moss-Cohen. Welcome to The Connection. Physician and geneticist Francis Collins has been a leader in the development of many medical breakthroughs and helped guide the country through a series of medical crises, including the COVID-19 pandemic. He headed up the Human Genome Project and was the longest-serving director of the National Institutes of Health under three different presidents. He retired from the National Institutes of Health in 2021. Collins says he wrote his new book, The Road to Wisdom, because he sees our divisiveness and our politics undermining our thinking, quote, including our ability to discern the truth, our understanding of science, and our anchor to the fundamentals of faith represented in our churches, unquote. Francis Collins became an evangelical Christian in his 20s, having grown up in a non-believing family where he was homeschooled until sixth grade. He believes that faith and science can coexist and can complement each other. He joins us on The Connection to talk about the value, the necessity of truth, science, faith, and trust in these polarizing times. And Dr. Collins, nice to have you here in our Philadelphia studios. Welcome to The Connection.
Thank you, Marty. It's great to be right here at the table looking at you.
I know. Isn't that lovely?
In the midst of this crazy time we're in the middle of. So thanks for the invitation.
Well, you're very, very welcome. We're pleased to have you here. You know, you've lived long enough to live through a number of different crises, as have I. Your book is about this crisis that we're in now, this kind of crisis of thinking. Is this a crisis of enormous proportions as you see it?
I think it's very significant. Yeah, you and I have been around a little while. We've been through things. We survived the 60s, and everybody thought our country was coming apart then.
Indeed,
and somehow
we did.
Kind of got it back together. But something very different is going on now that even historians would say is different than what our country has previously faced, at least not at this level. It is this divisiveness that has caused so many of us to move off into separate tribal alliances. And not only to surround ourselves only with people who generally agree with us, but to look at those other people who aren't in our bubble as not just misguided and not just a little confused, but maybe evil, maybe threatening, maybe people that are dangerous. This is not who we should be, but it's who we have become. And it's been driven heavily by all kinds of losses of civility, especially in social media. Our politics has been a big factor. By any measure, our politicians are even more polarized than the public is. So don't expect that's going to bring us together. But this is a dangerous place for us to be. If we really want to have a future that's based on truth and trust, we're not there.
Well, and I wonder how much you think COVID has helped to drive us into these corners.
By any measure, it has, although the divisiveness, the polarization was already there before 2020, when COVID suddenly emerged as this worst pandemic in more than a century, and certainly added to people's sense of being fearful and angry about why things weren't going well. That was already there, sort of as an undercurrent, and COVID just pushed this into a much higher level of accelerated anxiety and fearfulness and also divisiveness.
Well, you know, I'm thinking 4 years ago in 2020, before there was a vaccine, our hospitals were in crisis.
Oh,
there were refrigerator trucks outside of emergency rooms because people were dying at such a fast rate. We couldn't bury them fast enough. Our economy was in free fall. Have we forgotten? And it's only been 4 years. Have we forgotten the crisis of that time?
I think a lot of us, just by human nature, kind of suppress those kinds of memories of tragedy at a scale like that and an uncertainty about where it was all going and is it going to eventually come and get all of us. And yet, you would think that would be the moment where a common enemy, namely the virus called SARS-CoV-2, would have united us. But maybe because we were already in these polarized states, that instead of uniting us, it added further to the divisions because people began to say, well, I don't think that group over there has the right answer, and maybe the government doesn't have the right answer, and distrust of virtually everything continued to accelerate as it had already started to do before COVID came along.
Well, here I am talking to you, one of the preeminent scientists in this country. But on the one hand, we did get this vaccine in record time. which halted many, many deaths and many, many illnesses that really put people in critical conditions. But as you say, something like 60 million people said, I'm not getting this vaccine.
And that is...
And what was the price that we all paid for that?
A terrible price, Marty. And it's so hard in this most technologically advanced country to see how that outcome could have happened, because the data upon which we based the FDA did, the recommendation that these vaccines were ready for public use, was extremely rigorous. The trials were based on at least 30,000 volunteers, God bless them, who agreed to roll up their sleeves, not knowing whether they were getting the vaccine or a dummy shot, and then to be followed very closely for 3 or 4 months to see who got COVID and who didn't. And then when the unblinding of the data happened, because this is the way you do it, you do not know, even when you're running the trial, whether it's working or not until the end. And there it was, 95% effectiveness and no serious side effects in that group of 30,000 people. That was a night I will not forget.
Really? As you got the news, right?
Absolutely, because I had no right to expect it to be that good, because usually vaccines don't work that well. But there it was. And I confess that was a night I cried pretty hard.
You truly cried?
Oh,
cried
absolutely.
Tears of joy?
Tears of joy, tears of gratitude, tears of prayers having been answered. And I thought at that point, okay, this is a terrible thing, but we finally have a really powerful tool to stop the terrible tragedy all around us. But as you said, when we got to the summer of 21, by then anybody who wanted the vaccine could get it for free, and it was easily accessible. And something like 50 or 60 million people were not convinced that this was something that would be good for them. All of the misinformation had really taken hold about maybe there's a chip in the syringe, or maybe this is going to change your DNA, or maybe it'll make you infertile. None of those things were true, but a lot of people started to believe them.
Well,
and the terrible consequence, Marty, this is the saddest statistic I can possibly imagine, is that Kaiser Family Foundation, a nonpartisan objective group, really tried to assess what was the result of that in terms of lives lost. They calculated 234,000 Americans died between June of 21 and March of 22 because of misinformation.
That's a quarter of a million people.
A quarter of a million people. That's like, in that time period, 3 jumbo jets crashing every day. And that happened to us? To us? That is such a heartbreak.
You write, and I'm going to quote here, in the midst of the worst pandemic in more than a century, the sources, including me, referring to yourself, that were supposed to share objective information, admit uncertainty, and inspire public trust often failed to achieve that. Seeing the situation, people put their trust in other sources of even more questionable value, especially social media. Then you go on to say politicians piled on with a shocking willingness to distribute information that served their own purposes but was of unproven validity. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's a pretty powerful trifecta of problems.
It was. And one of those, I'm taking responsibility for myself as one of those who is trying to communicate information to people about what to do in the face of this pandemic. And I was one of those who was shoved in front of a camera rather regularly during 2020 and 2021. And I wish every time that had happened, I would have said right up front, hey, everybody, I'm going to try to give you the best recommendations that the smartest people at CDC and other places have come up with based on what we know right now. But we don't know nearly enough to be absolutely sure we understand this pandemic as well as we would like to.
You think that would have assured people?
I think it might have helped so that if the recommendations had to change 2 or 3 weeks later, it wouldn't have been such a surprise. I think, Marty, we lost people's confidence when recommendations like whether to wear a mask or not shifted from one point to the next, and it sounded arbitrary, and we didn't do a good job of preparing people for the fact that this is a scientific experience like none we've ever had, where you have to do the best you can with incomplete data while you're trying to gather more data as fast as you can. And so things are going to change, just like when you ask your stockbroker for a recommendation, you don't expect them to say the same thing 3 weeks from now as they did today. But somehow with public health, people began to doubt the competence of the experts when things changed over time. And we could have done a better job of providing some public education about this process, and we didn't do that very well.
Is it because we don't understand science? We think science is fact. Science is, you know, proven research that gives us the truth about something.
I think that is generally the attitude many people have, although some people don't trust science no matter what it says. But a lot of folks, I think, went into this thinking, okay, this is just science. They'll have it figured out. They'll tell us exactly what to do, and nothing will change. And that's not how it happened. Again, we missed the opportunity to do some teaching about the nature of science, which is you gather data, you make a hypothesis, you try to test it with the next set of data. Sometimes it turns out to be wrong. But over time, you build a whole network of data sets that's going to tell you something that's true. I mean, we know a lot now about SARS-CoV-2. We didn't know nearly enough in the summer of 2020 when we were talking about whether it was safe for people to actually start going back to their businesses or their schools. And so mostly people kept away from them. And that was really hard. It was hard on people's economy. It was hard on the kids being kept out of school. Nobody was sure about how long this should be lasting. It was local decisions often that directed that, but local decisions had even less in the way of public health expertise oftentimes to guide them. So it was much too chaotic.
I know this is a virus that keeps mutating. I just got my latest booster. You know,
so
hopefully that'll get me through the next
I got my number 7.
6 to 9 months or so. But are we going to face another pandemic, and have we learned the lessons of the one that we're, I guess, still in?
We are still in because the virus is still out there. We had quite a bump in cases in August. There's a little suggestion now it's starting to dwindle down a bit, but it's still not safe to consider this being over. We learned a lot. I would say in the science community, the experience we had with COVID was phenomenally useful in terms of learning what worked and what didn't. And then there's now a plan, although it takes resources to be sure it's ready, to actually have everything done in 100 days if a new pandemic virus appears. That would be a stretch almost beyond the imagination, but there's a pathway perhaps to get there. What I don't think we're well prepared for at all is how to best inform and encourage the public about what needs to happen. I mean, Marty, think about this. If there's going to be another pandemic in the next few years, betting odds are it'll be influenza.
Right.
It'll be a really bad influenza, like 1918, one of those that does spread rapidly by the respiratory route, and which is dangerous not just to older people, but actually to young people. A lot of those people died in 1918. If that were to happen, and we had evidence that it really was spreading at a frantic pace, and we would not at that point have all the measures we need to help, the recommendation would have to be that people should go and isolate themselves and things would have to be closed and masks would have to be worn. How is that going to be received at this point when so many people don't really believe that was right for COVID?
Well, let me pick up on that after this very short break. Talking with Francis Collins about his new book called The Road to Wisdom. Much more after this short break. We'll be right back.
The candidates for November are set.
I know Donald Trump's tight.
Between now and Election Day.
We are not going back.
A campaign season unfolding faster.
Kamala Harris is not getting a promotion.
Than any in recent history.
Make America great again.
Follow it all with new episodes every weekday on the NPR Politics Podcast.
You're listening to The Connection here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane talking with Francis Collins. He was the longest serving director of the Department of Health and Human, the National Institutes of Health. I corrected myself there. Serving under three different presidents, that would be Obama, Trump and Biden. He retired recently, but he's still working very hard. In fact, they're running a research lab at NIH, and he's got a brand new book. It's called The Road to Wisdom on Truth, Science, Faith, and Trust. Let me just pick up on something we were talking about, the next pandemic, and that last sentence that I quoted about politicians piling on. And I guess maybe undermining what it was that you and others were trying to tell the public about how to protect ourselves against this particular wily virus. Were there particular politicians you had in mind when you said that? And I'm thinking the president at that time, which, of course, would be President Trump.
Well, I don't want to go into specific examples of politicians, because one of the things I'm trying to do with this book is to try to reach out to people regardless of their allegiances and their political party. I think a lot of us are somewhere in the middle of this political spectrum, what a group called More in Common has called the exhausted middle. And some of us are a little on the red side and others on the blue side, and some are believers and some are skeptics. But we all have in common this fact that we're kind of tired of all of the noise coming from the fringes on the left and the right. And we're wondering, what happened to our country and how do we get it back? And this book aims to try to make a case for the kinds of things that have run off the rails, and the metaphor of this road to wisdom that we seem to currently have landed in the ditch. And how do we get back together on that lifelong trip? So in the book, I really have tried not to do too much in terms of pointing to specific individuals who have done unfortunate things with political voices to make things worse. But there's plenty of them, and it's not limited to one party or the other.
And I do want to get to some of the message of your book, if I can put it that way. But I think it's interesting, based on what you just said there, as someone who headed up the Human Genome Project, an extraordinary achievement, if I may say, the idea of essentially sort of understanding how human beings are built, how we are built from the cellular level. But what did that teach you about us human beings?
Well, it's our instruction book.
It is.
And I think historians will look back on that achievement, which was done by 2,400 scientists in six countries that I had the privilege of leading, as one of those really signal moments in the course of human understanding of ourselves and also our ability to understand how life works and how disease happens. So it was a big deal. This instruction book, of course, is in the language of DNA, which is somehow looks very simple, although it's incredibly complicated. It's just got four letters in its alphabet, these chemical bases that are called A, C, G, and T. And there are 3 billion of those in the human genome. And until this project was done, we only knew little snippets here and there. And now we know the whole thing. It's incredibly challenging to sort out how it works.
I can only imagine.
And we'll be at that for decades to come, although we've already discerned some pretty fundamentally powerful and inspiring things about its function and how it plays out in diseases like diabetes or cancer or rare diseases like sickle cell disease. And the progress has been stunning in the last 20 years since that first copy of the human genome emerged. Right. And so for me, as a person of faith, this does seem like a pretty significant bit of insight into the Creator's plan. So I wrote a book called The Language of God, referring to DNA in that regard. I do believe that we humans are a product of this evolutionary process, but I also see that as part of God's plan. Mm-hmm. So now we get to see exactly at the bottom of all this, what is driving ourselves to do what they do. How do we get to be this really complicated organism starting from a single cell, but a cell that had that instruction book to guide it?
And I do want to get to all of that. I wonder whether, even on a very simple level, the Genome Project tells us that we are all part of the same family, because it often feels that we are at each other's throats, that we're part of a different team of families.
I'm so glad you brought that up, because that is one of the most significant findings of the whole enterprise. We humans across the globe, regardless of our ancestry, we're really all part of one family. Yeah. Our DNA is 99.9% the same. We are all derived from a common set of ancestors living in Africa probably about 150,000 years ago. And there might have been maybe 10,000 or so of them. We are all derived from that. We're all Africans.
Right.
We traveled around a little bit and our biology changed a little bit to adapt to the circumstances, but we are all part of one wonderful human family. The only race worth talking about is that we are all on a race to try to understand ourselves.
Well, and according to you, we're all on this road to wisdom as well. When you use the word wisdom, it's more than just knowledge for you. It's knowledge plus.
Yeah, I think that's sometimes a terminology that isn't so easy to take apart, but wisdom has to depend on knowledge, because otherwise you're not going to be very wise if the facts are wrong underneath what you're trying to discern. But wisdom has to add some other things to that, such as a moral foundation, what's right and what's wrong. Knowledge alone sometimes is pretty free of any ethical consequences, but wisdom needs to tap into that. And wisdom also has to include judgment, experience, common sense, some insights from other perspectives. All of that together, I kind of like to make the difference clear in terms of various science fiction figures. So Spock would be a good representative of knowledge and rationality. Yoda would take that to the next level and add some wisdom. Maybe that helps.
Maybe that does help. Do you, this is a more personal question, do you feel as an older person that you have gained some wisdom in your years on this planet?
I hope so. I hope I've made some progress on this road to wisdom, which is the title of the book, and it's a journey I think we are all on. And along the way, you recognize that there's certain things that you have thought were wise that aren't, so you have to discard them. And then others come along that actually seem worthy of being added to your storehouse of wisdom. And for me now at age 74, I'm trying to do the best I can to be sure that my storehouse is full of the things that are actually reliable and then share those across various audiences, maybe particularly my grandchildren.
Grandchildren always keep us on our toes. You have an image of how you see truth, and you divide it into essentially four parts. In the center is something you call necessary truth, and it would be things like 2 and 2 is 4.
Mathematics.
Earth revolves around the sun. I mean, these are things that we know to be true. Then there are firmly established facts, which is conclusions that are supported by evidence. Then outside of that is uncertainty, potentially true, but we don't have enough evidence. And then on the outer ring of this circle is opinion, which are what people say, opine about whatever. Yeah. why is it important for us to sort of dissect what truth is?
I think it's really important right now, because it feels to me like truth is a little bit under attack. How many times have you heard somebody say, well, that might be true for you, but it's not true for me? And if the conversation is about a movie and whether it was really good or not, that's fine. Right. That's an opinion. Our society is enriched by people having different opinions. That doesn't threaten the order of things at all. But if it's about whether the earth is flat or round, there's a flat earth society that actually will argue that flatness is the right answer. I'm sorry, that's not true. The evidence against that is absolutely overwhelming. It's not okay to say, well, roundness might be okay for you, you globularist, which is a term that's used.
I didn't know that. Okay.
But it's not true for me. That is a dangerous kind of perspective to take. Let me take another example.
Sure.
Climate change. The data supporting, can I take a quick
sip? You sure can. In fact, let me just quickly reintroduce you. And again, talking with Francis Collins today on The Connection. He's got a brand new book called The Road to Wisdom on Truth, Science, Faith, and Trust. And let me just quickly describe your position. He headed up the Human Genome Project and was the longest serving director of the National Institutes of Health. Yes, go ahead.
So climate change is still a circumstance where honorable people may say, well, I don't know if I believe in that. Okay, let's look at the data. The data is absolutely overwhelming. The thermometer is not a political instrument. It has been used across the globe over many decades, and it's very clear that the temperature of the planet has been warming at an unprecedented rate since about 1950. And has now gained close to 3 degrees Fahrenheit over what its baseline was across the globe. And that's resulted in an increase in sea levels by about 7 inches. And we're headed towards things that are even more significant than that. And the evidence is also overwhelming that this is because of human activity and the way in which, by the burning of fossil fuels and other things that contribute carbon dioxide and methane into the atmosphere, we are turning this greenhouse into a much warmer one than is good for us. You simply can't look at the data and say, well, that might not be true for me. the data is absolutely compelling. And we shouldn't be wasting our time right now having that argument about whether it's real and whether humans are doing it. We should be talking about the actions that need to be taken. And a lot of that is happening, but it's still the case that there's some effort to try to dissuade people from taking it seriously. And again, political figures, there was a debate amongst presidential candidates where a question was raised. Please raise your hand if you believe that climate change is real and that human activity is responsible. No candidate raised their hand.
Unbelievable. Yeah, I wondered today whether that would be any different. But that whole description reminds me of Stephen Colbert talking about, you know, truthiness, the idea that, well, it feels true, so yeah. It must be true. But you also sort of deconstruct untruths, ignorance, falsehood, lying, delusion, BS, you use the real word, I won't use it on the air, and then propaganda, that there are all sorts of ways that we undermine truth that makes it difficult, I think, for a lot of people to understand.
Yeah, and that has various levels of evil intent. Just ignorance, that's not something that has sort of moral consequence. It's just that you don't know the information.
Right.
A lie, on the other hand, suggests you know the right answer and you're intentionally misrepresenting it. And of course, we know as fallen humans that we're all capable of doing that. The thing my daughters were most worried about when they were growing up was for me to come to them and say, did you lie to me? That was like the most serious thing that dad could say to daughter. And I think most of us in our families and our social acquaintances agree we should not be lying to each other. But now, in our current culture, lies spread like wildfire on social media, much faster than truth. And somehow it seems to have become acceptable for people to make absolute lies comfortable in their discourse without the need to try to correct them or apologize for them.
Alternative facts,
alternative
right? Whatever fact. That is.
There are no alternative facts. There are just facts.
Coming from Francis Collins, let me ask you about your faith. And you referenced this earlier, and it's, you know, you're not shy about it. The fact that you basically found Christianity for yourself in your 20s. I think you were in your late 20s.
Yes.
You grew up in a house that was kind of a-religious, so there was neither this nor that, right?
Right.
It just wasn't part of the discussion. And I often think that people become, it goes in reverse, which is people grow up in houses where there's faith, and then for whatever reason, if you become an atheist, you do it in your adulthood. You kind of did it in reverse.
Yeah, everybody has to make up their own mind.
Yeah.
It's not something you just take on board as a child, and that's the end of the story.
So what was it for you?
I was an atheist in graduate school studying physical chemistry, and then I got a change of heart and decided to go to medical school. And I entered medical school as an atheist.
But meaning you did not believe?
I did not believe, and I would be actually quite unpleasant to try to have a conversation with about God. I would say that's just an old-time superstition. You should get rid of that and focus on things that are real. But medical school had this other impact on me. It put me up close to suffering and death in a way that I hadn't experienced in my own life, and made me wonder about what's the meaning of all this? What's the meaning of my life? Why is there such a thing as suffering? By the way, why am I here, and why is there something instead of nothing? The big question that's hard to answer from an atheist's perspective. And I had a patient who on a particular afternoon just asked me very bluntly and directly, Doctor, what do you believe? Nobody'd ever quite hit
so
me with
directly?
That question. Looking me straight in the eye, this wonderful elderly woman whose faith was very much part of her life, challenging me, what do you believe? And realizing I really didn't have an answer.
Wow. And that set you on this
That set me
course.
On a pathway to try to figure out, okay, I better strengthen my atheism, otherwise this is not going to be a good time. And so there must be people who actually believe in God and who are not somehow intellectually second rate. So maybe I'd better learn more about that. And that led me to C.S. Lewis, and then that led me to the Bible. And I did a lot of reading of other world religions. But then I met the person of Jesus, this unique figure who not only had this incredible teaching about meekness and willingness to love your neighbor and your enemies, but also claimed to be the Son of God.
Yeah.
And you couldn't dismiss him as a good teacher and just ignore the rest. And kicking and screaming over a couple of years of struggle, I ultimately felt I could no longer resist and gave in. And that became the foundation of my life at age 27.
Well, you say that science explains how the universe, how nature works, but
yes,
faith for you explains why we are here. And speaking solely for myself, and I am an atheist, for me it's about philosophy, psychology, music, the arts.
Yes.
You know, all these other things that help explain, at least for me, why I am here and what my purpose is on this planet.
I'm with you about how those are enlivening and enriching and
yeah,
make meaning apparent. But those are also, for me, signposts to God, that right, why should beauty matter to us, whether it's in art or in music? Why is that? Why should love matter so much to us when sometimes it seems contrary to what a strictly evolutionary instinct would it be? Why do we admire somebody who actually sacrifices potentially their own life to help or save somebody they don't even know? Why do we see that as the noblest kind of human activity? Because from evolution's perspective, that's a scandal.
Yeah,
you
so
were
what,
supposed
we wouldn't
to protect
be here,
your
right?
DNA.
Yes.
That's puzzling. None of those things will prove the existence of a God who cares about you and me, but it's enough to make you think about it.
Mm-hmm. And for you, that was enough. I mean,
that was a lot
to
of
think
it.
About it got you believing got about it.
Enough to begin to explore, okay, that sounds like an interesting hypothesis of a God who's not just the creator of this amazing universe, which, by the way, is built in the way that only a physicist and a mathematician would have been able to come up with the natural laws that govern matter and energy and the constants that have exactly the value they do for something interesting to happen. All of that is pretty amazing when you really look at the data. But that doesn't get you to a God who cares about you and me.
Mm-hmm.
Where does that part come from? Mm-hmm. Then I get to love and I get to beauty and I get to the historical record of Jesus Christ.
Well, let's take another short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation talking about a whole host of things, science, faith, Jesus Christ. And Francis Collins is our guest today on The Connection. He's got a new book. It's called The Road to Wisdom on Truth, Science, Faith, and Trust. He headed up the Human Genome Project, and he also headed up the National Institutes of Health under three different presidents, retired from that particular position in 2021. He runs a research lab at NIH. Much more after this short break. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
The candidates for November are set.
I know Donald Trump's tight.
Between now and Election Day.
We are not going back.
A campaign season unfolding faster.
Kamala Harris is not getting a promotion.
Than any in recent history.
Make America great again.
Follow it all with new episodes every weekday on the NPR Politics Podcast.
You're listening to The Connection here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane talking with Dr. Francis Collins, former director of the National Institutes of Health. And again, he's got a new book. We've been talking about The Road to Wisdom on Truth, Science, Faith, and Trust. You have a section in the book about your relationship with Christopher Hitchens, someone I had the pleasure of interviewing over the years on a previous show, God Is Not Great, being one of his books, also his memoir, Hitch, among other things. And as you say, and I think it's really true, he knew the Bible better than most people.
Oh, yeah.
You also say, and I agree with you completely, whether you agreed with him or not, but he was a seeker of the truth.
Yes.
That and he was an avowed atheist. I mean, there was no question about it.
Yeah, it was not hard to tell.
But you really had this wonderfully warm relationship with him.
Yeah, that's what happened, sort of to probably the surprise of both of us. It started off a bit of a testy debating circumstance, and you didn't want to get involved in a debate with Hitch unless you expected to lose, because he was so incredibly effective in that setting. He was the most articulate person you could imagine. And he had the way of using metaphors and other kinds of devastating comparisons to what you were saying that made it very hard for anybody listening to do anything other than say, I think Hitch won on that one.
Yeah.
But I learned a lot from that. There's that sort of scriptural verse about iron sharpening iron. So if you want to really test yourself in terms of your beliefs, it's a good thing to put yourself in front of somebody who absolutely has completely the opposite view and do this jousting back and forth, because they'll help you see some weaknesses in your own argument that you might then need to work on. And that happened. And then we
Did he change your faith or how you
He helped me strengthen it, actually,
by
the fact that he did probe pretty deeply in such questions as why God allows suffering, which is the hardest question of all. But then ultimately, we became more comfortable with each other, and then Hitch got cancer.
Yeah, esophageal cancer.
Esophageal stage 4. The initial diagnosis seemed like, oh boy, this is not going to last more than a few weeks. It was just at the point where, because of the advances of the Human Genome Project, we were able to begin to try to look at a specific cancer and say, what's driving those good cells to go bad, and how would that help you choose the right treatment instead of the one-size-fits-all sort of carpet-bombing approach? So that was done in a clinical trial that he took part in, and sure enough, it turned up a misspelling in the DNA in his cancer cells that suggested a particular treatment that had been used for leukemia but never for esophageal cancer.
Wow.
And so he got on that drug.
Yeah.
And I think it gave him some extra time. Yeah. He survived another year and a half. And during that year and a half, we saw a lot of each other. He had an apartment in D.C. I would pop down on my motorcycle and spend a little time with him, oftentimes looking at the sunset over D.C., talking about cancer, but mostly talking about everything else, because he was such a polymath. He knew so much about every topic. It was just a whole experience to be there. We became actually quite close, and I grieved significantly when we lost him. And I still think now and then about, boy, it would be fun if Hitch was in this room right now.
Oh, boy, would it ever. Oh, my goodness. Well, he said about you, Francis Collins, the best of the faithful.
That was a very generous comment on his part.
And especially coming from an avowed atheist, to call you the best of the faithful.
Well, maybe he thought that was a low bar.
Yeah, maybe. But you also, you composed a sonata for him.
I did.
Hitch and Sonata for the piano.
Yeah, when I was in his apartment, there was a piano, and I would often just play. And I'm not somebody who basically picks out something and carries my sheet music around. I just play whatever comes to my mind. It was after he died, and I came back to that apartment to visit with his wife, Carol Blue, and I just felt the urge to play something, and I thought it was going to be some sort of somber, minor key kind of piece, and instead it wasn't. It just sort of came out as something much more upbeat and lively, and it stuck in my head. And so when I was asked to speak at the memorial service for Hitch in New York a month or two later, I decided I would play that.
Yeah.
Which was a very odd thing, I suppose, for these gathered luminaries of the literary world to have this scientist show up, talk about faith, and then play the piano.
Well, I watched it and I listened to it, and it's lovely and heartwarming. You know, your relationship with Christopher Hitchens reminds me of something you did for a group called Better Angels. Mm-hmm. And this was titled, An Elitist and a Deplorable Walk into a Bar. You were the elitist,
I sure was.
You were the elitist, and a guy named Adam Wilkinson was the deplorable.
Yeah.
And the two of you, I guess, debated.
We did.
What, COVID?
It was about public health responses to COVID. And this was at a Braver Angels annual meeting, symbolically located in Gettysburg, Pennsylvania.
Oh, goodness, where the great Civil War
with about 700 people equally divided between reds and blues. And I had gotten to know Adam, he goes by Wilk, Wilkinson, over the course of the preceding year and a half. And we had started out in a very sort of tense place with very different views about what went right and what went wrong. But I listened to him, and I really listened to him, and I began to understand how he, as a guy who runs a trucking company in Minnesota, saw a lot of what was happening with COVID is really out of sync with what would have been appropriate for his rural community. All of these various pronouncements sounded like they would work in New York, but what about him? Having his business closed when there were barely any cases around, having his kids out of school for a long time, having this whole business about masks, yes, masks, no, it was just enough to drive him, who was already a pretty conservative guy, mm-hmm. to lose his trust in the government. But I learned from him how that could very well happen to a totally reasonable person. And that taught me some of the things that we talked about a little earlier about some of the failures in our own communication that could have been better and maybe would have been a way to keep Wilk on board instead of having him just lose trust in the whole enterprise. So it seemed like a good idea for us to have that conversation in front of people as kind of modeling. How can you be in a very different place as far as what you think is right, but not denigrate each other, not shout at each other, actually listen, actually be able to admit your own failings, which I did and he did. Mm-hmm. That's what we need to do more of.
Well, we're in the middle of this contentious political season. Are there lessons from that for all of us?
Oh, yeah. And in the book, the last chapter, I try to put forward a set of recommendations of what maybe all of us can do to try to turn this around. It's one thing to say, our country shouldn't be like this, because that's true. Another would be to say, I shouldn't be like this. What can I do to try to begin to get us back on that road to wisdom? And one of those is to actually make an effort to reach out to people who are not part of your echo chamber or your bubble or your tribal alliance, whatever you want to call it, who you know have a different opinion about something, and you've been kind of afraid to talk to them because sometimes those conversations don't go well. You could construct it so they would go better if you reach out and say, I really want to understand you. Hmm. I know you and I are different on this particular point, but I know you and your family, and I think we all want the world to be a better place for our kids. Can we talk and just explain to me where you're coming from? I need to understand your background, what sources have influenced you. And I'm not going to try to change your mind. I'm just going to try to understand it.
Hmm.
And people will accept that, I think, if they know they're not going to be grilled.
Well, you need a willing partner.
Yes.
In order to do that, you also talk about being a wise consumer of information.
Yes.
Don't share dubious social media information.
Yes.
Asking us to kind of inventory our own biases.
I think that's another critical part of what we need to do right now. If we in the exhausted middle are going to be part of the solution, you do have to kind of look at that collection of what we call established facts. We were talking about that a little bit ago in terms of these various levels of truth. Are there things that have smuggled their way into your established facts that maybe really aren't established, that came from an unreliable source but just sort of sounded good? And are they coming at you now and are even tempted to hit the like button or the share button and become part of something that goes viral that actually wasn't true? It's up to all of us to try to re-anchor ourselves in something that's called truth and not be so quickly distracted by things which are not good for us. So if you put those things together, the effort to reach out, build bridges with people who don't agree with you, to focus your own efforts on what is true, and to do all this with love and understanding and refusing to take offense, then I think we might have a chance of getting ourselves back together.
Well, I sure hope you're right. Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Francis Collins. And again, he's got a new book, The Road to Wisdom on Truth, Science, Faith, and Trust. You have a section, we were talking about your faith in this book, and you have a section on the rise of the nuns, N-O-N-E-S, mm-hmm. the U-M-S, the ums, and then the duns, D-O-N-E-S,
I'm done.
Yeah. And I did an interview a couple months ago about sort of the rise of the nuns, so to speak. Something like 25% of the population really has no religious affiliation, no connection. And to you, that sounds astounding. I mean, what does that, as a person of faith, how do you see that?
Well, it's the most dramatic change for American society ever recorded. If you go back to about the turn of the century, that number was about 7% that were no religious affiliation. Now it's almost 30. To have that happen in the space just 25 years is dramatic indeed. Yeah. So a overwhelming disaffiliation seems to be happening, particularly amongst young people. Yeah. I think they have not found religion as providing them with the kind of wisdom, insight, comfort that they had hoped. And I'm sorry to say some of that, at least, kind of reflects the way the church has itself gotten a bit misled by political messages. I'm an evangelical Christian.
Right.
If people are not in my particular tribe of evangelical Christians, you hear that description, you think, oh, those are the people that are bigoted. They're hypocritical. They're all political. They're driven by right-wing ideology. You would not think to yourself, oh, that's somebody who really loves Jesus.
Hmm.
We've lost the thread there. Now, there are lots of wonderful evangelical Christians sitting in the pews on Sunday morning trying to do their best to live up to what the Bible calls them to. And they're also frustrated, like, what happened? But our churches have been riven in many instances by arguments that have nothing to do with faith and everything to do with politics. So no wonder people would go, I don't know if I want to be part of that. The faith that I adhere to is not what's been created by humans in their church construction. It's the faith that I read about that was created by God and by Jesus. And that hasn't changed. And that still has this wonderful potential to give people an opportunity for flourishing. But the church doesn't seem necessarily to represent that in all instances.
Well, let me ask you about some of those humans, not all of them, obviously, but I mean, there certainly are charlatans that talk about prosperity gospel as if, you know, being rich is some reason that God loves you more than other people, or frankly, subverting the message of Jesus about loving people by targeting gay people or transgender people, the Catholic Church and the child abuse scandal that has rocked that particular institution. I mean, there's a lot that maybe the church, I'm not blaming God or Jesus for this, but that it makes it difficult, I think, for people to believe.
Yes. And again, I think that reflects not that people have necessarily decided that the principles of faith are wrong, but the way they're practiced by the human institutions called the church doesn't seem to fit anymore. So a lot of those folks who are nuns, and certainly most of them who are just done, may not have really lost their confidence that faith could be meaningful. They just don't feel like the way it's represented by the church is something that they resonate with anymore.
I read that you were diagnosed with prostate cancer. Yes. I believe had surgery earlier this year.
Yes.
How are you feeling? How is your health?
Marty, I'm doing fine. I knew I had this cancer 5 years ago. It was moving rather slowly, nothing much to see here. Yeah. And then it decided to become much more aggressive earlier this year with a rapid rise in this PSA test, which tells you, and imaging that showed what had been not a very impressive looking lesion suddenly began growing. Wow. So action needed to be taken. I was fortunate to have the chance to take part in a clinical trial so that my own experience will add to knowledge for others. And the surgery, which was not a small matter, basically seems to have gone pretty well. And I'm optimistic that I'm on a good path here to have been cured by the surgical intervention. It'll take a few years to be sure.
Yeah. And was it a robot that did the surgery?
It was a robot. Absolutely.
I read that. Yeah. Wow.
The Da
How
Vinci
was that?
Robot. I was asleep, so I don't know. But actually, to be clear, the robot is managed by a surgeon.
Right.
Just the robot is doing all the action. The surgeon is off in the corner pulling the appropriate levers and pushing the right buttons to be sure that everything goes the way it was supposed to. And I had a fantastic surgeon who'd already done something like this for about 1,000 men before he got to me. So he really knew his stuff.
We have no time to talk about this, but I know that you have teamed up with opera singer Renee Fleming on something called Sound Health, which is exploring the healing powers of music. And yes, I can only imagine the richness of what you're exploring there.
It is such an exciting endeavor. And being able to do this, Renee, with Renee has just been a joy. I grew up in a family where music was a big deal. So I learned early on to sing, to play various instruments. And it always sort of felt like that part of me was over here and my science part was over there. And now to bring them together, because music has this incredible impact on the brain and our emotions. And we have a project at NIH that's really figuring out how the brain works, and music fits nicely in there. And if we can figure out exactly how music can put us in an emotional state of healing, we could take the field of music therapy, which is already vigorous and exciting, and tie it in even more intensely with a scientific understanding of how it all works.
And you're a guitarist, right?
I am a guitarist.
Lifelong?
Yeah, pretty much. And yeah, since I was a kid and a keyboard player. I'm in a rock and roll band.
With who else?
A bunch of scientists, of course. We're called the Affordable Rock and Roll Act because we're free. We're all federal employees. We can't accept money.
Well, Francis Collins, it's been such a pleasure. And I thank you so much for joining us today on The Connection.
Marty, it's been great with you, being with you. This has been a really interesting conversation.
Well, thank you so much. And again, Francis Collins' new book is called The Road to Wisdom on Truth, Science, Faith, and Trust. And he headed up the director of the Human Genome Project, and he also was the head of the National Institutes of Health for three presidents. Go to whyy.org/The Connection to find out more about the program. You can always download a podcast of the show wherever you get your podcasts. You can follow us on Instagram and find us on Facebook. And check out our website, whyy.org/The Connection, for information for upcoming shows and to sign up for our newsletter. Al Banks, the engineer for today's edition of the show, produced by Debbie Builder and Paige Murray Bessler.